gender. I shall tell you the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was, and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss, and to go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast, that he was, and is not, and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven. And he goes to destruction. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw, and the beast, these will hate the harlot, and will make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh, and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose, and by giving their kingdom to the beast, until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city, which reigns over the kings of the earth." So here we had, in chapter 16, we had the great harlot introduced. Here we have the great harlot described, we saw in verses 1 through 6. And as we saw the description of her, she was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations, the unclean things of her immorality. In other words, she has everything to attract and to seduce a heart and a mind that's set on the flesh, the things of this earth. She has worldly power. She has prosperity. She has ease. She has comfort. She has influence. She has a religion that appeals to and flatters and gratifies human pride and fleshly desires, all to seduce away from the worship of the one true God in devotion. She has nothing to offend, nothing to convict, nothing to make anybody uncomfortable. Everything is just as the fleshly heart and mind could wish it to be. And even her religion, it all focuses on self. It's self-effort, self-salvation of one form of another. Now this was the system, the harlot, that seduced Israel. Israel sunk, you remember your Old Testament history, Israel sunk into spiritual harlotry and apostasy. Well, why did they sink into this? Well, Psalm 106, verse 35 tells us why. They mingled with the nations and learned their practices. They mingled with the nations that were dominated by this world system, this system of the harlot, and they learned that system. They learned its practices. See, the spirit of this world, the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience, is the mother of all harlotry. It's the product of the human mind, human wisdom, the elementary principles of the world, the man-made religion that is of no value against fleshly indulgence. It's all this is the product of the human mind, human wisdom, human effort. And it all sets itself against the one true God. It sets itself against the knowledge of Him. it's hostile to God and to His ways, because it is diametrically opposite and opposed and hostile and incompatible with the spirit of this world, with the system of the harlot. And the harlot and her system that she represents hates to have this system exposed for what it is. Darkness hates the light and won't come to the light. And so it persecutes those who rip off its mask and expose its true colors, the true colors of the world. See, Satan and the harlot are in league with one another. So I would see she rides this scarlet beast. They're in league with the God of this world. Uses the harlot to blind the minds of the unbelieving to the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ. And if Satan can hide the world's true colors, if he can represent the world to the mind as something other than what it really is, as something other than what the Bible describes it to be and declares it to be, and get us to see the world as he would represent it, instead of in its true colors, a harlot, then he can blind the mind to the light of the gospel and the glory of God, who is the image of Christ. And he can seduce people into mixing and mingling with the world, with the nations, and learn its ways, its practices, its thinking, its values, its reasoning. And we were just been talking about the state of so much of professing Christianity today and its leadership. It's corporate. It has adopted. It's mixed and mingled with the world to where it has now adopted the world's management structure and the world's way of thinking and reasoning and practices. And then in the same way, it adopts the world's way of thinking in terms of how it forms its judgment as to what is good, what is evil, what's right, what's wrong, what's clean, what's unclean, what's Christian, what's unchristian, what's moral or what's immoral. Remember, and we've looked at it a few times over the past couple weeks, 1 Corinthians 2:12, that now we have not been given the spirit of the world, but the spirit of that is from God. See, if the believer had the spirit of the world, then they could be at home in this world. They could mix and mingle with the world without any problem. They could partner with the world in the world's causes and its politics and its humanitarianism and its social causes. It could be friends with the world, and the world would think well of them and admire them. But Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 6:14 and 15 that the believer has nothing in common with the unbeliever, because they're of two totally different spirits. As John states over in 1 John 3:1, see how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason, what reason? The fact that you're a child of God, not of this world. For this reason, the world does not know us, because it did not know Him. So they're incompatible, completely incompatible. And so Satan tries to hide the true colors of the world. Well, here in Revelation 17, John has been shown the harlot in her true colors. And it says, at the end of verse 6, he says, "When I saw her, I wondered greatly." I wondered a great wonder. John sees her in her true colors. Not as the world sees. Not as the world represents itself. But as God sees the world. Remember Daniel's visions over in Daniel chapter 2 when he interprets actually Nebuchadnezzar's vision, interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue, which was four successive world empires, the head of gold, which was Babylon at the time, the arms and chest of silver, which would have been the Medes and Persians, then the belly of bronze, which was Greece, the legs of iron, which was Rome. But there, it's these nations of the, and these kingdoms of the earth are represented as this great, glorious statue. But you go over into Daniel 7, and there's the image of the beast, these terrible, raging, violent beasts who just kill and destroy. That's these kingdoms from God's perspective. One is from man's perspective, one's from God's. And when John saw the harlot, it caused him to wonder. Because she's much worse than he could have ever imagined. He'd been told by God. It had been revealed to him. I mean, John is the apostle who describes the world as terrible. If anyone who loves the world and the things of the world does not have the love of God in them, right? John understood how wicked the world was and its system. He wrote more about the world and its dangers than any other New Testament writer, and warned about the world, and saw the world as and believed what God said about it. But now he's seeing it by sight. Before it was by faith, now it's by sight. He's seeing this system in its true colors. See, those who would be friends of the world, the harlot, her system, who would drink from her cup, well, they have to suffer the same fate as the world, the harlot. See, the harlot's not just false religion, but it's the world that is the mother of all false religions. The world system, the spirit of this world that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Under the domain of darkness. This world whose wisdom is demonic, according to James 3:15. Well, in verse 7, the angel asked John a question. The angel said to me, "Why do you wonder?" And the angel's question indicates that John's reaction is inappropriate, given all of God's warnings and examples concerning the danger and the wickedness of the world. I mean, you got Lot's wife, right? You have Demas, even the whole nation of Israel. So his wondering is inappropriate given the revelation that God has given concerning the world. And so the angel asks, why? Why do you wonder? Why should you be so amazed at what you're seeing? I shall tell you the mystery of the woman. In other words, it's similar to what Jesus told the disciples on the road to Emmaus. Oh, you who are slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have said concerning the Messiah. In other words, it was revealed to them, but they just didn't get the full import of it. And that's John. And now he's seeing it by sight. And he's just horrified by it. And so this prompts a further explanation from the angel. I shall tell you the mystery of the woman, nor the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. He's going to reveal this mystery. Notice it's in the singular. I'll tell you the mystery. It's one mystery. The mystery that's composed of the woman and the beast because they're so closely related. The beast carries the woman. So we saw in verse 3, I saw the woman sitting on a scarlet beast. He carries the woman, as verse 7 says. I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her. And the word means to take up, to bear. See, the harlot is not dominating the beast, but is dependent upon the beast. It's a dependence, not a dominance. He supports her, she does not support him. In other words, their fates are intertwined. There's a mutual dependence here. One cannot succeed without the other. If one fails, so does the other. It's like a king and his kingdom. The fate of one is the fate of the other. Satan doesn't have a divided kingdom. They're working. This world is the kingdom of Satan. He is the god of this world and its system. So they work together, the harlot and the beast. And then verse 8 begins, and it's this revelation of the mystery. It begins with the beast. In fact, the beast dominates the description that the angel is giving to John here. There's an extensive description, explanation of the beast, whereas the harlot is just a little bit. In verse 15 and 17 and 18. But the explanation of the beast has three parts. First, there's the beast himself in verse 8. Then there's the explanation of his horns and heads in verses 9 through 11. Or rather, his heads in verses 9 through 11. And then the explanation of his horns in verses 12 through 14 and 16 and 17. And so you have this section of Revelation is a classic example of how the Bible interprets the Bible. There's no need to search for hidden meaning or to spiritualize. The revelation, or what is being given here, is expanding on the information concerning the beast and the harlot given in chapters 11 and 13. And so, the first thing that is given speaks of the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go to destruction, and those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. And so, what are these seven heads that are being talked about here? Ten horns. Well, we're told the seven heads are seven kings. So the seven heads are seven consecutive world powers that are directly connected with the nation of Israel. They influenced Israel. They dominated Israel. They corrupted Israel. Israel learned their practices and their ways by mixing and mingling with them. And again, this coincides with Daniel's vision and or Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the statue and Daniel's interpretation of it in Daniel chapter 2 and 7. It concerns the future of Israel, not the church. So who are these seven kings that are world powers that directly connected with Israel? Well, it was Egypt. There were the Assyrians. Assyria corrupted the nation of Israel. In fact, you can look over in 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 10, where it speaks of Ahab and Ahab going to visit the king of Assyria. Chapter 16 of 2 Kings. Now, King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw the altar which was at Damascus, at the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest the pattern of the altar and its model, according to all its workmanship. And so, Ahaz goes to visit the king of Assyria, sees the altar that the king of Assyria has, has a copy made of it by the priest of Israel, and as we read on, we see that Ahaz actually has it set up in the house of God, takes down the things that God has commanded, the bronze sea and the oxen that supported it. And at the end of verse 18, it says that he did all this because of the king of Assyria. And so Assyrians greatly corrupted the nation of Israel and their worship through the Israel mixing and mingling, copying and learning and practicing their ways. And then there was the Babylonians after the Assyrians. So you have Egypt, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. They also corrupted Israel and Israel learned and mixed and mingled and practiced. In fact, when it came time for the remnant to return to Jerusalem after 70 years of Babylonian captivity, it was just a very small portion of the Jews who actually went back to Jerusalem to rebuild it. The rest of them had settled down in Israel or in Babylon. They were at home. And then after the Babylonians, there were the Medes and Persians. Then there were the Greeks. Then there were the Romans. And then the seventh will be the final world power under the Antichrist. And so this is the beast. The beast that you saw, verse 8, was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Those who dwell on the earth will wonder. And so he's about to come. He was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss. What does it mean he was? That's his rise to power. In chapter 13, verse 3. And I saw, or actually, it's his rise to power that where he comes up out of the sea and he's given power by the dragon. Then is not, that's his fatal wound, verse 3. I saw one of the heads of this that had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And then about to come, that's his resuscitation, where he's comes back to life and is amazed. But then he is to go to destruction, which chapter 19, verse 20 tells us that the beast was seized and with him the false prophet, and they're thrown alive into the lake of fire. But all the unbelievers, those whose names were not written in the book of life before the foundation of the world, all of these are going to wonder. Remember, that's what they did over in chapter 13, verse 3. And that the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they said, who is like the beast? So verse 8 is purely prophetic. It's all future. And actually the name that's given to the beast here, that was, is not, and is about to come, is a counterfeit of God's name, I Am. Only thing is, God is never, is not. Never can be, never will be. So here again, a counterfeiting of the name of God. Then verse 9, here's the mind that has wisdom. Here's more information. Wisdom, the Greek word is sophia. It's spiritual wisdom and insight given by the Holy Spirit. Remember, Paul said that we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit is from God. Why? That we might know the things freely given to us by God. So spiritual wisdom is required to grasp spiritual truth. And so here's wisdom, this spiritual wisdom that's being given so John can understand what's taking place. He can see behind just the mere appearance and see the spiritual behind the temporal. And that's what's required to know what these seven mountains represent. That seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There's seven kings. Verse 10. No, we're seven kings, seven successive empires on which the woman sits. Empires of the world which interacted with Israel, that corrupted it by Israel mixing and mingling with it. These empires of the world that were governed by the principles of the world. And that primary principle is, and always is self. Man is ultimate. Man is the center of all thought. Not God. Man is the starting point of all thought. He's the center of all thought. Not God. And of course, the result of this is materialism, worldliness, self-worship, self is exalted. God and His Christ are dethroned. Forms of godliness are substituted for the power of it. See, the heart of all apostasy is loving the creature and the creation more than the Creator. It's adopting the world's thinking, reasoning, and its values, and the way that it forms its judgments of what is good and evil, right and wrong. And all of these are related, the way it forms its judgments, whether it's good, evil, right, wrong, are all in relation to self. See, what benefits in the world's thinking, what benefits man is good. Whatever is harmful, unpleasant, contrary to our self-interest is bad. How something impacts my feelings, my happiness, my gratification, my rights, that's the test. That's the standard of whether something is good or bad, not the word or the will of God. And so man becomes the standard in how things impact him as to how, whether they're good or bad. And see, so God's will can't possibly include hardship, trials, self-denial, obedience, separation from the world, if doing so is going to infringe on my happiness and my worldly pleasures. Because anything that man deems as bad can't be God's will. So man ultimately becomes the determiner of what is and what is not God's will. Now this system is very attractive to fallen man, because the world standard and its standard of good or bad, right and wrong, just or unjust, success or failure, can be measured in terms of immediate results, or at least almost immediate results. It's instant, immediate gratification. It's good if it produces the desired effects, and it's bad if it doesn't. And of course, this is what dominates the culture of the church today. If something produces growth, if it generates numbers, if we can build big buildings, and we can be a megachurch, and we can be attracting all sorts of people in, then whatever you're doing, that must be good. And if it's not working, if it's not accomplishing whatever our desired results are, then it must be wrong, or it must be bad. And so we have to try something else to discover what's good, and good is whatever accomplishes we want it to accomplish. And so today, the world's thinking has deemed that it's bad to call sin what it is. Instead, we've come up with all these sanitized, whitewashed euphemisms for sin. It's no longer homosexuality, it's same-sex attraction. It's no longer perversion, it's gender confusion or gender fluidity now. They're not even confused anymore, it's just fluid. And so there's all these sanitized euphemisms for sin. It's bad to call sin what it is. It's bad to deny someone the right to live in their sin. It's bad to tell someone they go to hell if they're not a true Christian. It's bad to say that what someone believes and the way they live is wrong, sinful, and unbiblical. This is the world standard of bad. And this is what's been adopted by much of the church today, the harlot system. And the harlot system has deemed that it's good to instill a false security, to make someone feel good about their sin, to boost and encourage their self-love and self-esteem, to partner with the world and its causes and to be friends with the world. All that's been deemed good by the harlot, and it has been adopted by the bulk of professing Christianity. That's why the Christian test of good and bad is foolishness to the world, because it bears no relation to the temporal, to the immediate, to the material, or to our worldly well-being. But it's whether is it the will of God, is the standard God's Word, is the rule revealed Scripture. That's the Christian standard. The Christian assumes that God's Word and His will is always best, even when it goes against our own self-interest, our own sense, our own experience, causes pain, hardship, frustrates. Because we walk by faith, not by sight, which is a characteristic trait of the world. They walk by their own understanding. It's not that the Christian never does, but we understand that it's part of the flesh that we need to crucify. It's not the habitual pattern of their life. So the displacement of God by man as ultimate, as the central focus of life, as the object of our ultimate affection, as the goal of our existence, to set the mind on the things of this earth. This is the system of the world. This is the harlot. This is the mother of all harlotry that dominates and is dominates today, not just in the world, but within the bulk and the mass of professing Christendom today and the majority of churches. And really, even in the system of government we have, because only when God is displaced by self and the world can a system of government and a system of religion that exalts man and his freedom, his rights, his free will over God's law, God's rights, God's will, and God's word, only that can succeed. God has to be usurped and replaced by a system that exalts man and his freedom, not God and his word. And that's what we have here. And this is what we have here. This system, government system and religious system that exalt man, not God. And they are mutually dependent for their success. And so here's the interpretation. Verse 10. Again, no need to wonder. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. So, and there are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. Five have fallen. Well, at the time of John's writing, five had fallen. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. One is. At the time of John's writing, it was Rome. One, the other is not yet come, or is not yet present. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. That's the kingdom of the beast, the final world power. And he remains a little while. In other words, it's going to be much shorter than the other six empires. And then he says, and the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and goes to destruction. What's that about? The seventh is also the eighth? How? Well, after his resuscitation. He was not, now he is. So it's after his resuscitation. And then we get into a description of the horn. So that's the description of the beast. Now we get a description of the horns. The beast is composed of these seven heads, these seven empires, world empires, that of course are all under the dominion of the dragon, this satanic influence, in partnership with the world system, the god of this world, blinding the minds by this worldly system and by the spirit of the world. And so now we come into the ten horns. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings. These are the beast's horns. They're the ten toes of Nebuchadnezzar's statue he saw in his dream. The ten toes on the feet made of a mixture of iron and clay. In other words, it's a confederacy of ten kings led and ruled by the beast. Over in Daniel chapter 7, verse 7, and in verse 24 of Daniel 7, we read, verse 7, after this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and had large iron teeth that devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had ten horns. And also, verse 24, as for the 10 horns out of the kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. So, this is going to be in the last days, as it says in verse 12. The 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Now, it's a short period of time, a brief, short period of time, shorter than the beast kingdom. And they have one purpose. One purpose. It doesn't mean they don't do other things while they're exercising their authority as kings. But their whole rise to power and being given power is for one purpose. Similar to what God told Pharaoh. It's not that Pharaoh didn't do a lot of other things during his reign, but God told Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up, that I might display my glory through you. That was the whole purpose for God raising up Pharaoh, was to display his power through Pharaoh's rebellion in freeing the people of Israel. Well, now these 10 kings have been raised up, and they have one purpose. And they give their power and authority to the beast. It's a united support of the beast. They relinquish their national sovereignty and give it to the beast. They're essentially globalists. You know, they're relinquishing their national sovereignty and giving it to the beast. And what is the purpose of this giving all this authority to the beast? Verse 14, these will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. Notice the called and chosen and faithful are with Him, but the battle is His. He is the one who is defeating. He is the one who is conquering, as Revelation 19:14 states. The armies which are in heaven, clothed in white linen, or clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following Him on white horses. But it's from His mouth that come the sharp two-edged sword that slays and destroys all those in rebellion against Him. And so, this war against the Lamb, this long war against God and His Son, is coming to a climax. But of course, it's a futile war, because the outcome is certain, there's no question about it, and it's because He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And you can't defeat the Lord of lords and the King of kings. It's futile. Despite all that Satan has tried to do, it's futile, and the outcome is certain. And then there's a mention of the woman again, verse 15. He said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. See, it's this world spirit, the spirit of the world that dominates the world, that is now operating in the sons of disobedience. All that characterizes the world. See, this is why the believer is not to be of this world. We're in it, but not of it. We've been chosen out of this world to be separate, set apart, distinct. We're to be a stranger and an alien in it, and no longer conform to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You don't think the same way the world thinks. You don't have the same values, same principles, same tastes. Everything is different. You see things in a different way. You view things with biblical glasses. And then, back to the horns, verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot. Notice it's future tense. They will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. So this confederacy turns on the religious system when the religious system becomes a threat to the beast and his power. And again, this just shows that the futility of trying to be a friend of the world. Because the world's going to be swallowed up by the ruler of it. And so he will turn on her. He makes desolate. In other words, he will confiscate her wealth. All the wealth, all the that the harlot has, her purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, her golden cup, all that, going to confiscate. All her wealth is going to be gone. He's going to make her desolate and naked. And he's desolate, again, just take everything she has and naked. Expose her moral corruption. Expose her for what she really is. She'll lose all her spiritual influence. The spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience will no longer have the same influence, because it will be directly the influence of the beast. He won't have to work through the harlot anymore. And he's going to destroy all those who follow her system, because he's not going to allow any competition. He will not allow the worship of the creature or the creation over the worship of the beast. He's going to demand total devotion. And he will burn her up with fire. In other words, just a total destruction of her system. The world system. And it's all going to come to him. Well, why do they do this? Verse 17. For God has put it in their hearts to execute His purpose. Notice in verse 13, it said they have one purpose. These 10 kings. And that was to give their authority to the beast, so that they could all join in this rebellion. But also, they joined for the destruction of the harlot. God has put it in their hearts to execute His purpose by having a common purpose. This is what they had at Babel, right? They all had a common purpose. And that was to, let's go make a name for ourselves. They don't want to make a name for the harlot. They want to make a name for themselves. So God put it in their hearts to execute His purpose. They think they're executing their purpose, but unwittingly they're executing God's purpose. And how do they execute His purpose? By having a common purpose. By giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. See, God is the sovereign ruler who rules over everything. He rules over all powers, all people, all devils, all events, all nations. And He does so all for the good of those who are called, who are chosen, those who are chosen out of this world, who are not of this world. So God doesn't need man to save the world. God doesn't need us to redeem the culture. God did not come, Jesus Christ did not come to redeem the culture. He came to redeem a people for His own possession and take them out of the world. The culture is the world. And the world is irredeemable. It's going to be destroyed. But God works all things according to the counsel of His own will, His good and perfect will. And so He puts it in their heart to execute His purpose. See, the reason people want to save the world is because their heart and their mind is set on the world. The reason they want to save the culture is because their heart and mind is set on the culture. Their home is this world. They are those who, as Revelation says over and over and over again, those who dwell on the earth. They love this present world and their life in it, and they worship this world. They're of this world. And therefore, they will suffer the fate of this world and its system. In verse 18, back to the woman. The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. It's the great city, the dominant city, the mother of harlots. It's this city that reigns over all the kingdoms of the earth. Babel is the mother city. Let us make a name for ourselves. It's the spirit of that city, the spirit of this world system that now works in the sons of disobedience, the self-worship, self-exaltation, that man is ultimate, the creature over the creator. This is the system, this is the spirit which true believers have been called out of. As Peter said and wrote to those in 1 Peter 4:2, that God, beginning 4:1, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. See, the world and its system lives for the lusts of men. Those who are of God live for the will of God. Two totally, completely contradictory, competing systems, irreconcilable system. And so any system of religion that tries to go halves with the world, that tries to compromise with the world, tries to find some kind of middle ground between obedience to God and His Word and His commands of the gospel and with the world and its system and its values, is going to suffer the same fate as the world. It can't help but imbibe the spirit of the world. And again, we're seeing this in spades all around us today. Everything from the corporate mindset of the church to the requirements that people look for in pastors in a church, to the values and the lifestyles of professing Christians, to the apostasy from the obedience to the commands of the gospel. When Paul said, come out and be separate, that's God's message, and that's what He's called us to. This was the message to the seven churches. If they were to avoid the judgment of God, they had to either hold fast to what they had, or they had to repent and come out of that world system, whatever form they had gotten into. Because the fate of the world is destruction. And the same is true today. The same message applies today. Those who profess to be believers need to come out of the world. The churches and the people that belong to them need to come out of the world. Come out and be separate. And that's the message of much of the book of Revelation, because the alternative is suffering the fate of the world that is given here. What do we have?